Now, Ireland is one of the wealthiest countries in Europe, but scratch beneath the surface and you might find a growing divide between the generations. The richest 10% own nearly half of all the wealth in this country. That's over half a trillion euro. And 97% of household wealth belongs to people who own their home. So if you don't, you're locked out. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Sean Defoe. That divide I just described falls fairly neatly across the generations, with older Irish people sitting on the wealth of the Celtic Tiger and post-crash recovery, while their children and grandchildren struggle to buy their first place. Increasingly, those kids might still be living at home into their 40s, or, if planning laws change, in log cabins in the back garden. The so-called locked-out generations of millennials and Gen Z face the very real prospect of being worse off than their parents. So how long can Ireland's wealth be held or defended by its older generations? And what does it mean for social cohesion if younger people see security as permanently out of reach? To dig into the facts and think about what they mean for the future, I'm joined by Dr. Barra Rowntree, Assistant Professor in Economics at Trinity College Dublin. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Welcome to News Talk Daily. So you are obviously, you look, a very well-respected economist, and naturally I'm going to start with a social question first. Is it not a bit natural for different generations to be a little resentful of each other?
It is. No, absolutely. And I think there's always this kind of tension across generations, but underlying it in the Irish context is that situation that you describe, where there is the prospect, and perhaps even happening now, where for the first time generations are no better off than the previous one. And that's not a normal circumstance. Like, normally you have countries growing and you have people better off than their parents and their parents better off than their parents. And it's not entirely clear that that is going to continue on. And a core bit of that is around housing. But it's not just housing. Housing, I think, is the core bit. But we saw kind of after the financial crisis of the late 2000s, coming out of that, people born in the 1980s in particular, their earnings were suppressed for many years. And so they actually did have lower incomes at the same age than people born 10 years earlier. And that was really striking. And now, you know, that's starting to maybe fade away. But we did have already a situation for about a decade where there was a generation who were worse off than people born 10 years earlier. That's not a normal circumstance.
Mm.
That's at risk, I think, of maybe happening again, or at least for a subset of that cohort.
Yeah. So what generation are you? I'm in the Church of Latter-day Millennials. Are you? I think you're a millennial as well. You
just about squeezing in at the end.
into it. So, like, I feel in particular with millennials, get an awful lot of hate. Mm. Like, I remember I read this article the other day on the Guardian, and the headline was "Millennials Set to Be the Richest Generation in History." And I thought, that kind of goes against everything we've been preparing for this. And when you read the article, it was, yes, millennials will be the richest generation in history when they inherit the wealth of their dying parents.
Yeah, no, again, and there is always this tension between generations. I mean, it's kind of thing that happens. And, you know, you go back and look at the 70s and the 60s and you had kind of similar type things. But again, what I do think makes this situation different, perhaps not unique, because it is happening in some other countries as well, but what does make it a bit different is that there's meat to it, if you like. It's not just that our parents are moaning about us and we're moaning about our parents. It's that there is these real set of difficult challenges underneath, some of which are due to labour market, but most of which are to do with housing and wealth and how it's held and how it's passed on and who has it.
Yeah, and to start on that, and the figure that I introduced there was sort of remarkable. 97% of household wealth belongs to people who own their home. That seems like a remarkable figure. I almost don't believe it.
Yeah, no, and again, I think it is this situation where, and it's true again in many countries, but wealth is much more unequally distributed than income. So if you want to think of, you know, how much wealth do you need to have to be in the top 10%? You need to have just over a million in net wealth. So that's your assets minus your liabilities.
Right. So that is your house, but minus the mortgage, plus any cash you might have.
Exactly. Plus any cash, plus any, maybe if you have some stocks, maybe if you have a private pension. The total value of that needs to be more than a million. And again, netting off the liabilities, netting off what you owe, that's to get into the top 10%. Whereas if you look at the bottom 10%, they have less than 2,000.
Wow.
That's a difference of at least 500, right? In terms of, if you want to think about the difference between someone who's just getting in the top 10% and someone who's just in the bottom 10%. Whereas if you think about how big is that difference, if you look at income, if you look at the money kind of that people receive, and you take account of tax and benefits, it's 3, right? So wealth is a lot more unequally distributed than income.
Right.
And some of that is natural in the extent that, you know, how do you get wealth? You tend to accumulate it over your life. In particular, for most people, it's going to be you pay off your mortgage, right? You buy a house, you have a mortgage on that, and you pay off the mortgage. And as you pay off the mortgage, that's how your wealth increases. And maybe you're also putting a bit into a pension, or your employer is putting a bit into a pension.
Mm.
And that's how your wealth kind of increases. So there's this kind of natural life cycle effect to wealth. There is an extent to which you would expect wealth inequality to be more than income inequality. But we also know, and I think this is the key bit, that it's becoming a lot more so across generations.
Yeah. But you pointed out there that obviously wealth does increase over time. You're going to be wealthier, most likely in most cases, in your 60s. You might have paid off the mortgage. You've just been around longer. You've had more opportunity. So why then does this seem unnatural? As in, why has the divide gone beyond just the natural curve that's always been there through history, that if you're around younger, you accumulate more stuff?
Yeah, so most of it is, again, down to housing. So if you think about, say, at age 30, for people who were in the 1960s, about two-thirds of them, so two out of every three, owned their own house by age 30. That's fallen to a third for people born in the 1980s. So across a couple of generations, we saw home ownership rates just plummet at age 30. In terms of where they're heading, it looks like for future generations, home ownership rates are going to be a lot lower. So again, think about people who are retired today. 90% of them own their own house, and most of them outright. They don't have any mortgage outstanding. Mm. They own it outright. But whereas if you think about people who are, say, in their 30s today, we did some work a few years ago looking at this, and it's looking like it'll probably get to about 50%. So that's a huge reduction, right? So going from people who are retired today, 90% of them own their own house. People who are going to be retired in about, 30, 40 years, it's going to be only half. And that's, again, because housing is such an important asset, that's going to act to increase wealth inequality, both between generations, but also means within the cohort, right? There's going to be a bunch of people who do own their home, and then there's going to be half who don't. And that raises a huge set of issues.
Well, it's massive, because if you even think in a friend group, you know, you've got five friends that you hang around with forever since college or whatever, and half of them may not have a home. Did that factor in the projections that the government has, as much as people won't want to, you know, don't believe them because we haven't seen the evidence of it, that there will be more houses built over time? Like, I suppose it's not a fait accompli that we'll reach that.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And there are things that we can do to kind of change that. But even under the most optimistic scenario, we're looking at home ownership rates coming down from 90% to a lot lower.
Right.
Like, it's not going to be, it'll be down at 85%. We're talking about it being, you know, less than 70%, less than 60%, even under the, if things go well.
And when we talk about the timing of housing in particular, because we often hear people will say, yes, they bought, you know, I was just saying to our producer, Tom, here before we came in, the one thing that annoys me more than anything is when you're speaking to an uncle or somebody and they say, oh yeah, bought my house, built it $12,000 on an acre of land, you know, no bother. And you're just there screaming internally, trying not to ruin the family dinner. But then they will always say, yeah, well, we had 15% interest rates and it was really difficult at the time for us. But the thing I come back to is income versus house prices, which is very, very different in this generation to that.
Yeah, huge generation. And again, even, you know, why were there 15% interest rates? It was because inflation was very high. And so that meant that the effective value of that debt that they'd taken on was getting eroded very, very quickly. So if you own a house, inflation is great in a way, right? Because it means if you've got a mortgage on it, your mortgage payments are fixed. Fine interest, if you need to refinance, mortgage rates might go up. But it means that very quickly, because, you know, if inflation's going up, your earnings are probably going up, maybe not quite as fast, but they're going up as well. And so after a couple of years, suddenly what seemed like a very expensive mortgage repayment actually in real terms isn't that much. So I agree. I think when uncles or aunts or parents kind of bring up this topic, I think they're exaggerating maybe their own hardship. Things were bad in Ireland before. Like, Ireland has much improved, but again, in terms of the affordability of housing, it has gotten worse. I think that's just unambiguously true.
And have some generations, out of flukiness or just the being born at the right time, been able to take advantage of lower house prices at certain times?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like, so you think of, in particular, when we had our most recent housing crisis, or our biggest one that we've had ever in the history of the state, really, what we saw was house prices absolutely plummet, and they were probably at the lowest in 2011, 2012. So anyone who was able to get a mortgage then, who's in maybe a secure job, who was in a job and had good earnings, they probably got a steal, right? And we know since then house prices have increased by, you know, 100%. So you've got a bunch of people who, if they bought in 2011, 2012, have seen these huge capital gains. And again, I think that's one way of rationalizing for, I often find myself in this position, but you see house prices up for sale and you kind of know where you are in the income distribution. You go, how in the name of God can people afford this? And a lot of the time it's because they bought a house in 2012, maybe the most recent one, and they saw huge gains in it, they're selling it, and they've got that extra bit of equity, or they've got parental wealth. Because there are lots of people I know who are kind of go, I'm on good earnings, how can't I, you know, why can't I afford a house? Well, the reason is because you're competing against people who either had parental cash or who maybe are looking to buy a second home and got a huge capital gain on that first home. There's lucky people, but there's also the very unlucky people, right? There's people who bought maybe 05, 06, then saw the value of their property just plummet and weren't able to move for many, many years. You know, maybe now they're probably out of negative equity, but not everyone. There are still, like, I think we forget just how much the excesses of the Celtic Tiger were in particular areas, or that, you know, there are some people who paid money that even now they mightn't get back on that home. So there's a lot of people in that situation who lost a huge amount of money. So, and I think what makes that so maybe real or vivid for many people is that they know someone who's maybe a year or two ahead of them in school who got into the labour market at just the right time, or just managed to miss the crash and was in a secure job, or maybe they were in a public sector job before the public sector stopped hiring in the late 2000s and were able to buy a house then, and whereas they had to emigrate, you know. So I think you get a lot of that within generational kind of inequality as well. So it's not just across generations. There's some people within generations who got very lucky and have done very well. And again, it's not really due to anything that they did themselves. They just happened to come out of school or college at the right time.
Yeah. Does that fuel the circle, or fuel the wheel almost, in that the most recent crash we had, if you were rich, or you, not even necessarily rich, but particularly if you were and you were able to buy an investment property, you know, you're sitting on the money now, and that will deepen it, because their children will have more access to wealth, and the people who are struggling just to get into it are forever going to be in that situation.
Yeah, that's, and again, we see that in terms of the statistics that come out from the Banking Payments Federation about, you know, the share of first-time buyers who have help from their parents, and that's just creeping up and up and up. Unsurprisingly, because house prices are just so high, and so there is then this issue of, it's not just inequality across generations, and not just that us millennials are kind of bitter about our parents.
Hard done by.
Horrible. Sorry, hard done by millennials are bitter at those.
Don't get Kira Kelly started.
But it's also within that group. There are some millennials whose parents had investment property, or when their parents unfortunately die, have a house that's very, very expensive and pass it on. And again, you know, for many people, that's not at the time they might like it. It'll tend to be a lot later in life when they might have maybe wanted a cheaper home earlier. Mm. Again, if you bought a house yourself, you're probably more likely to be inheriting a large amount later on as well. And so clearing the mortgage on that maybe particularly quickly. And then there's a group of people who are just not going to be able to buy their own home given the current policy environment. And even if things get a lot better, there's going to be still quite a number of people who won't be able to buy their own home. And we haven't really, I think, come to terms with that in terms of how we structure things like pensions, the welfare system, the wider society. It's all, or a lot of it, is resting on the idea that people own their own home in retirement.
Yeah. It's an interesting one to hear you explain it in the way you have, because, look, I don't come from any money. We grew up in council estate, single parent family. Myself and my brother have both done quite well and are now a part of that generation who have been college educated, probably the most educated generation of Irish people has ever been, working in good jobs, and are struggling to get the lifestyle that should be associated with that. And lots of people have been writing about this. I mean, David McWilliams, he's been talking about the locked out generation, and he went as far to describe it as intergenerational apartheid. Which sounds very strong, but is it very strong?
Well, again, I think there's a very real inequality there. And I think that's what maybe that's picking up at, that there are a bunch of people who don't see themselves. And it's not just a small minority, right? There is a reasonably large share of people who don't see themselves as going to be able to have the same life that they saw their parents have, or maybe saw their cousins have. And I think, not unsurprisingly, that breeds resentment. And again, we've kind of focused on housing rightly, because housing is, I think, the biggest fundamental issue here. But it's also true in terms of pensions, right? So people previously, both in the public and private sector, they had access to much more generous pensions. I think that the public sector difference is much more stark, and that it just happened in 2013. But if you think of new entrant teachers after that time, or nurses or doctors into the public sector, all of them are on a pension that is far, far less generous. Now, it's still a very good pension, right? And that's a subset, but a large subset of the population. But again, there's just this really stark inequality of, like, pre-2013, you've this extremely good pension. Post-2013, you've still a very good pension, but it's a lot less generous.
Yeah, and you're one of the people who tends to annoy News Talk listeners in that you think there should be a later pension age in Ireland. Mm. And there was political war over this a few years ago when they wanted to push it out to, I think it wasn't 68 and then eventually 70. It's now pegged to 66. Why do you think, because a lot of people, again, comes to that resentment thing, well, my parents retired at, could be 55 if they were a guard, but somewhere in their early 60s to mid 60s. And now you're saying that not only do I have to rent longer or pay more for this, but I'm not going to have to work later in life to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think the key bit is, if you look at the demographics of where we are, we're going from a country that's extremely young. There's like, if you look at the share of the population who are less than 50, it's very, very high by international standards, but it's going to decline quickly. One way I've heard this described, which I think is quite a nice way of looking at it, if you're in Italy, you see lots of old lads out sitting on benches, right? Ireland's going to have similar demographics to that in about 20, 30 years, right? And we don't at the moment. So we're going to age very fast. And so then there's a key question of, well, how do we fund the state pension? And that is another way as well, actually, that policy has really lumped the costs onto future generations. Because we've said, rather than saying that people who are approaching retirement age today, well, they're going to retire a year later, and people who are maybe a decade away, they might retire 2 years later. What we've said is, no, state pension age is staying fixed to 66. And we're going to tax those of working age more. So through what's called pay-related social insurance, which is just another tax on earnings. It's got a different name, but it's just another tax. And we've said, but you only pay that if you're of working age. You don't pay that if you are retired. I don't think that's sustainable into long term. So fundamentally, I think what you will see is that the working age of today get taxed more and then also end up having to retire later. And that, again, they shoulder essentially the entire burden of the adjustment.
What's the answer to that? Because I've heard people raise this concern before. The government seems to be going about it in the way you described, plus auto-enrolment, making sure people have a private pension of some degree that the government will help them along with a little bit. But it still, for me, doesn't address the answer that if we've a whole bunch fewer working people when we're retired, who aren't paying as much into that pot, I don't feel confident there'll be a state pension I can draw on reliably.
Yeah, I think there will be one, but it'll be less generous than otherwise, right? I think that, and that's the key bit. Now, how can you might try offset? Well, you can try do things to shift the demographics. So you can try encourage people to have more kids. Maybe a worthy endeavour, but not very successful. Whenever they try jack up child benefit or, you know, give baby bonuses, people don't really respond that much to it.
It's very hard. The cost of childcare would certainly help on that front. But that's an aside. I take your point.
It could. Then the other thing, and this is going to be a big issue into the future, I think it kind of interacts a lot with the politics today, is, well, you know, migration is that going to be part of it? You know, that would be a very plausible way where you shift the demographics. Because, again, migrants who move to a country tend to be younger. They tend to be of working age. And so in that sense, that could help with the issues of sustainability of the pension system, but then you're into the politics of it and into this kind of environment today. So it's not clear cut that, even though that could, I think, be a big part of the solution, it's not clear cut that it will be. Then you're left with, okay, well, who's going, you know, how are you going to spread those costs? And really, I think it comes down to, well, are we going to ask those who are retired now or those who are approaching retirement to shoulder more of the burden? And there's no signs that we are. And again, that's, I think, a lot down to the nature of politics that group tend to vote, younger people don't. Mm. And as a result, that's why we get things like the state pension age being fixed at 66 and tax being increased on the working age population. That doesn't look like it's changing anytime soon.
No, it doesn't. And politically, like you say, it's difficult to grasp. Like, there would be a certain irony in trying to explain to some of the people who are out in the Ireland is full crap that, you know, well, actually, your pension is going to be paid for by more migration. Politically, like you say, it's very, very difficult to the economics of it. The one thing that I wonder about, given all that is going on and the various millennial bashing that has been there, there's not mass protests. Mm. There's not people out in the street in the way that there was during the financial crisis or the austerity years or anything like that. There's a certain amount of people voting with their feet and heading abroad, but net migration, it's not that big. No. And there's a lot of people who are going for a few years knowing they're having a bit of a jolly and an adventure as well. Housing is a big part of it. It's not like people are banging down the doors of government buildings every week on this one issue saying generationally, you've got something wrong here.
No, it isn't. But you do see it's like analysis that's been done by, you know, political analysts shows that it's one of the big reasons that you're getting changing in voting patterns is around that issue of housing. Now, whether different parties' policies would result in any meaningful difference is a debate you can kind of have, right? But it does look like it's feeding into at least how people are voting, but it's not into that dissent or protest. But that said, we've always had maybe this issue in Ireland whereby, you know, emigration has served as, if you like, or sometimes called a safety valve, right? Where essentially those who are disenchanted and disaffected move and vote with their feet. And it's not at the levels it was before. It's not like it was in the late 2000s. It's not like it was in the 80s or the 70s or 60s or the 50s or the 40s. That has always proved a way in which maybe politicians and the governments have been able to avoid, I suppose, the real pressure that might come about from that is because many of those who are maybe most upset tend to leave.
Well, that's what I think Paddy Duffy was saying on News Talk last week when we were talking about extending the voting rights in presidential elections. He said the angry locked out people may just have left the country and they take the worst of that sting with them. And just finally, and there's so much we could talk about on this because it goes cross societally. The generation I would be really worried about, or the people I would be, is those who are going to be renting into their 60s and 70s and into their retirement, because we have no evidence to say in 30, 40 years that we will have this fantastic housing system, or even a, like a council housing system of the past, where if you were in that situation or bad luck befell you because a relationship broke up or whatever, you had that relief valve of social housing and council housing. But I don't care what your pension is. It's a very big demand to be expecting to pay rent through your retirement.
Yeah, it is. And again, very few people do it at the moment. So 90% of people currently retired own their own home. 7% or so of the remaining 10% are in social housing. And so there's only a very small number of kind of private renters at the moment. And that's really going to increase. So again, the work that we've done suggests that, you know, it's going to go from only 1 in 10 not owning their own home to maybe half. And there's a real question then, well, how are they going to afford that? Because as you say, with any substantial rental payment, even if we're not talking about private sector rent, even if we're talking about cost rental, which is, you know, a good sensible policy idea, where the rents that you pay are tied to the cost of initially building that property. But even still, if you're talking about someone being in cost rental, say at age 40, maybe they can afford the rental payment in their 40s and 50s, but when they get towards retirement, they can't. And there isn't, the system hasn't been designed such that there's something that can bridge that gap. Mm. It's something that many people have pointed to the need for when it was cost rentals being introduced. You need something like HAP, maybe, whereby even for someone in cost rental, if they lose their job or particularly if they move into retirement, there's something that can bridge that gap. But there's nothing at the moment, and governments have kicked the can down the road because it's, they're hoping, I think, that things get a bit better and that the issue is less difficult to deal with. But you're going to need to do something like that because it just isn't going to be possible for those people to cover the rental payment. You're talking about 1 in 2 people not owning their own home. Like, that's a huge, huge social challenge that we're going to have to deal with and that we don't currently have a plan for.
Yeah. Thanks, Boomers. On that slightly depressing note, Barry Rowntree from Trinity College Dublin, thanks a million for joining us on News Talk Daily. That's it for today. Kira is back in the chair tomorrow. You'll be delighted to hear. It's been great having your company, though. Over the past week or so, I will be back with a new episode of Let Me Explain on Thursday. So depending on when you're listening to this, it may already be out. But for now, from me, Sean Defoe, enjoy the rest of your day.